Welcome to Geek Brunch Retrocast.
Yes, number 14.
Indeed.
How are you, my friend? I haven't talked to you in a long time.
I know, it's been about a month. I'm doing pretty good.
Thanks for subbing for me.
I was just going to say, I've been in the meantime, I've been on all your other podcasts.
Yeah.
But that's been fun.
Yeah, I still got one more weekend coming up, and then I'm done until Baltimore.
Yeah, what's coming up, Phoenix?
Or Albuquerque.
Albuquerque. That's right.
Yeah. You would have loved Heroes this year. God, it was freaking awesome, man.
Yeah, I could tell from... I saw a lot of photographs from you and other people that were there. It looked like a lot of fun.
Yeah, it was a blast. It was a good time.
Now, do you know how many years offhand that you've been going?
I think since 2008.
Okay.
Consecutive. Yeah, I haven't missed a year.
So would you say this is the best one yet, or?
Well, it gets better and better because we're less and less at the con. I don't know. It's we're hanging out with people more than actually being at the con. But the time that I did spend at the con, it was really quality because usually it's like on Saturday, it's like really hard to move because there's just not enough space for the number of people they have.
Yeah.
But they opened up a whole new section, and while it looked empty, there was still, you know, a lot of people there. It just, you had space to move because they, like, doubled the space. So, like, you still have the same number of vendors, and your artist alley is still the same, but there's just the walkways are a lot longer, you know?
That's
They're
good.
A lot wider. And so you don't feel like rushed, like you're blocking anything, or if you stop to chat with friends in the middle of the walkway, you don't feel like you're blocking the flow of traffic. It's pretty awesome.
Yeah, it's good that they expanded the space, but didn't feel like they had to fill everything.
Yeah.
No, it sounds a lot more pleasant.
And we had a... I think it was Saturday, we went to downtown and we just walked around like they were having this like spring thing where you buy these tokens and you get to buy beer with it or food or whatever you guys, you know, whatever you wanted. And you try things in samples. Like, it wasn't large quantities, but it was freaking awesome. There was a group of us that did that, and that was pretty fun.
Yeah, it looked like a block party or something like that.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I saw that scent. That looked cool.
Yeah, I did get to meet a listener of this show. I met a couple listeners, but I think some of them are for DC Noise and some are for Geek Brunch. But Paul Price, who posts often on our Facebook page, I did get to meet him, and he's really nice and cool. I'd like to get him on the show if we could at some point.
Yeah, that'd be great. I'm definitely familiar with his name from his comments and stuff on the show. And I think was there a picture of you with him? I think I saw.
I had a picture with him with Daryl.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He posts a lot on the Taylor Network too. He does the ranking thing like I do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I saw that he was there. I wasn't sure if that was a first meeting or not, but that's cool to find out it was.
But I had a good time. I mean, I'm still exhausted. I'm still like haven't recovered because we got back and I didn't get much sleep. I mean, it was like 4 or 5 hours a night, you know.
Yeah.
Roughly, and then you're back and doing stuff because you're staying out till 1 or 2 in the morning every night.
Mm-hmm.
And we got back and a fire started like on Tuesday, and friends that we know that we play softball with had to vacate their home because they're a mandatory evac, and they've been living with us since. I think they can return home like today, so.
Yeah, I saw you guys mentioned that on Facebook, and I also have seen it in the news.
Yeah, it was like 390 homes. It was really bad. And I have so many friends that are, like, out of a house right now. I mean, I know people that have lost their house. I know people that are still out of their house trying to live week to week, you know. Oh, can I borrow a room? That kind of thing, you know. So,
yeah,
it's pretty chaotic. And it smells a lot. So if listeners hear me sniffling or clearing my throat, it's because of the smoke, and it's also because of the strong pollen count right now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think we both have the same allergy symptoms.
Yeah.
Whenever you hear you clear your throat, it sounds like me clearing mine. I try to hit the mute when I can, but...
Yeah, sometimes when you're talking, you don't realize you're doing it, you know?
No, yeah, I definitely...
It's just like... But I'm pretty bad, and I already know I'm going to be pretty uncontrollable this episode.
Yeah, I try to do a pre-podcast clearing, but that only lasts so long.
Yeah, I did that. I blow my nose and everything, and I try to get it, but when the pollen's in the air and it's in your house, and Harley's like rubs in the grass and then brings it all in, it just is pretty bad.
Yeah, growing up, I never really had allergies, and I thought I was only one of my family that didn't really have issues. And then for some reason, it may just have been college living and, you know, the fact that my roommates and I never dusted or anything like that may have aggravated them and brought them out. But in my early 20s, all of a sudden, they got really bad for a while, where I always had to be on some kind of medication. Nowadays, I rarely have to take anything, but I always have a bit of a post-nasal drip that especially gets aggravated if I eat anything creamy.
Oh, really?
So a lot of times after I eat, I clear my throat a bunch.
Yeah, I heard you guys talking about milk. I was like, it sounds like Bill's drinking spoiled milk if he's getting, like, phlegm buildup in the back of his throat.
Yeah.
It sounds like it's clunky. Like, I don't think he reads the date or anything. Like, he just drinks it.
Sounds a little nasty.
Yeah. Milk is not bad.
Milk should not have chunks.
Yeah, it should not be thick.
No matter what the...
Unless it's spoiled, then it starts to thicken and have chunks.
Yeah. Do not drink retro milk.
Yeah, do not drink retro milk.
But, so did you have any retro experiences at the con? Did you get any old comics or...
No, I focused a lot on, meeting people and, I got some sketches and I guess they... none of them are really retro. Everything's current. I didn't buy any comics. I looked through a lot. I almost got Spider-Man versus Superman, but I couldn't get it to the price I wanted, so I didn't. Mm-hmm. I didn't get it. Mm-hmm. I didn't buy too much old stuff. I should have, because the first day there was like a hardcover, more than 50% off, like on some old DC and Marvel stuff, like the Milestone books and the, what do they call them, the archives from DC.
Mm-hmm.
And they had like the old Charlton. The ones that I wanted, they sold out on day two when I felt like carrying stuff around.
Mm-hmm.
The first day I was just kind of like scoping everything.
Yeah.
And I didn't really buy much. And then the second day, I found stuff I wanted. And then every time I went back, everything I wanted was gone. And the third day I found some Doom Patrol books, and I was going to get those, but they sold out by the time I went back for them.
Uh-huh.
So I guess if you find something that's obscure, the lesson is to buy it right away. The stuff that's not so obscure, you could find throughout the con.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah. But I got some cool... I guess this is kind of retro. I got a Betty Page Rocketeer sketch from Andrew Peepoy, who does artwork on Archie Comics, and he's doing some web comics right now.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's called Simone and Ajax. And he's got a really cool style. It's like somewhere between Archie and Dave Stevens, like from Rocketeer. So that was a really good sketch I got. And then he did a big barter for me. I got a lot of big barter sketches. Keith bought me one of them.
And, yeah, I was going to mention, if you didn't, that not at Heroes Con, but at Denver Comic Con, you got a big barter.
Yes, from Matt Kent, and it was colored and everything. It cost a pretty penny, but he only does like one sketch, like the whole con,
mm-hmm.
because he's blowing up, and it's awesome to see, because mm-hmm. last year I could get in line and I could talk to him for a long time, and now he's got, especially at Heroes, he had a huge line, like all the time.
That was awesome.
Burning books left and right, and I think he's awesome. He's like one of my heroes. And I guess it's kind of retro. I got my yearly Tom Scholey in sketch, which featured Triton and Karnak from the Inhumans. So now I have him. He's done the entire Inhumans except for Crystal and maybe Quicksilver for me. And I guess if you want to include Black Bolt's evil brother, then I don't have him either. But I have Lockjaw and Gorgon and Black Bolt and Medusa, all the major ones.
And going back to Matt Kent, when you say, I just want to point out for any listeners that when you say burning books, you mean literally.
Yeah, Matt Kent is wonderful. For one thing, is He hasn't learned yet that he's blown up. Like it hasn't become reality. It's almost like when Scott Snyder was doing Detective Comics,
uh-huh.
and he wasn't like huge, and then he just started to do Batman with Capello, and now you have to wait in a line to even talk to him, and mm-hmm. you can only talk to him for, you know, a minute if you can, and then the next person comes up.
Yeah,
but Matt Kent, like, will sit there and chat with you just about everything. And I got to meet his wife, and that was awesome. And I picked up – well, I had Red Handed because I pre-ordered it from previews. And Red Handed has a page in the book. I think the chapter's called Firestarter or something like that. And I didn't know what he was doing. Every book I've ever bought from him, he does, like, an awesome personalized sketch inside the inside cover. And in this one, he pulled out a lighter and he lit the page on fire, and it really caught fire pretty big. And I'm like, what is he doing? And my jaw just like dropped because I didn't expect him to do it. I said, will you sign it? He says, do you want the deluxe signing? And I'm like, hell yeah, because I thought he was going to draw on it, right? and he caught it on fire. And it's really cool because the burn is like on a woman's legs, and you can see the legs continue in a different panel. Like he knows what he's doing when he burns it. And it's a personalized burn because every burn is different size.
Yeah.
I got a pretty good size burn on mine. And then I bought the tooth from him at Heroes, and he's got a signature thing in there where he cuts out a page. Cause if you're, this is retro. Do you remember the comics where it'd say like either cut out the stamps, like the Marvel stamps, or you'd have those little things where you could draw a character,
mm-hmm.
like a turtle or whatever, and then you cut it out and you'd send it to the Art Institute and they'd grade you, and then they'd say, yes, we want your money, no matter how bad you drew it.
Yeah.
Yes, you have talent. You should come to the school. But, he does the same sort of thing, so he like brought out the scissors and cut a page out of my tooth before I read it.
Nice.
Yeah. So I have all of his work now. He's currently writing Martian Manhunter in the back of Justice League of America, and it's fabulous. And I did read Mind Management, and it blew my mind. It's fantastic. But none of that's retro, so...
Um, Yeah, that big Barda sketch that he did for you was amazing. I mean, that definitely relates not only to retro, because she's a character that came out in the 70s, but to this specific podcast, because we've been talking about her, and I saw that. It just blew me away.
Yeah.
It's one of the best commissions I've seen somebody get in post
Facebook. Like, the thing that's wonderful about commissions is that's the only one in existence. He's probably never even touched Big Barda before.
Right. And he might not ever draw her.
He might ever draw her again.
Unless somebody else commissions them.
And it is fantastic. And, you know, like, I had Peepoy draw Elastigirl because she's another one of my favorites. Mm-hmm. And he drew a nice Elastigirl, like, from the 70s. So that's kind of retro.
Yeah.
And I picked up a page of Daryl getting his head kicked off, too. But that was a page from The Colonized, which is pretty recent.
Oh, yeah. That's a cool personal, you know, that's a personal connection. That's a good idea.
Yeah.
It's no,
because he always says, I'm going to kick you in the throat. And that's exactly what the guy did. He kicked Daryl in the throat and then took his head off.
Now he knows he's a media mogul for real. He's been killed again in the comic. But yeah, I think that's a. Well, I was just going to say real quick that I think that's a nice approach that you are taking to have. To not necessarily get a creator to draw a character that they're known for, but to get them to draw one of your favorite characters that you might not ever get to see them draw.
Yeah.
That's a really good way to take advantage of a commission.
You know how much I love Big Barda, so it's like, it's hard for me to pass up on any kind of Big Barda. I love it. It's good stuff.
It's awesome.
And while not retro, I did hang out a lot with Aaron Campbell and his wife. I found out they're in Albuquerque, so I'm going to see him again this weekend. And Aaron does retro books, even though in the current, I guess they could be considered retro in the time frame that he draws them. But he draws The Shadow, which I absolutely love. Like, I'm tempted to buy a page from it because I love it so much. And I don't usually buy pages. But I got to meet him and his wife, and I'll see them in Albuquerque. So if they still have the page I want, I think that's what I'm going to get there.
Nice.
And somebody there, we were talking Shadow like for a long time. We had a long discussion, and he was telling me something about there's an app called Retro Radio, which you can download on your phone, and you can hear like old episodes of The Shadow. So I am probably going to check that out.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's amazing. If you have an interest in old-time radio, I mean, the internet has tons of stuff available. You know, I think a majority of the old-time radio programs and stuff that really, for a lot of people, that was their, you know, main entertainment.
Mm-hmm.
You know, before television and stuff, and a lot of that stuff's available pretty easily on the internet. I mean, a lot of it's, I think, public domain, and you don't have to pay anything. You get a lot of it for free, I think.
Yeah, so I'm looking for it. I never realized how much I love The Shadow until now. I don't know if it's because I'm into the current writer, but it spawned me to like want to go find out about like the old Shadow books, and I know I have a few of them because I used to collect it back in the day. But there is the Shadow run that DC did. Let me see if I can find it real quick. The first series was like Archie, I think. The second series, I don't own that one either. At least my database says I don't own it. But that one's by Denny O'Neil and Kaluta, so I'd like to pick that up. Matter of fact, I think I am, like, going to go on see if I can get them on, because they're like 20-cent issues from DC, so it gives you the rough time frame, 1973. And then the third series was Chaykin, which I don't own. And the fourth series I do own a lot of, but I don't have a complete run. That was Bill Sienkiewicz and Andy Helfer. And I have most of that run. And then the fifth series is Dynamite. And I can't tell you how much I'm loving that series. And now I want to see I want to hear the radio so I can hear his voice, hopefully the way that he speaks. Because when they write his caption boxes, it's definitely different, you know? Like he's he's not the, when he's his alter ego, he talks normally, but when he's the shadow, his voice just changes dramatically.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of like Batman. I'm the Cookie Monster.
Yeah, I've read a little bit of that, and they do a good job of sort of keeping the mystery around the shadow, you know. And I haven't been reading the main series recently, but I have been picking up the Year One series because it's Matt Wagner doing it.
Yeah, I have those two, but I haven't dug into them yet.
Yeah, I think I only read one or two of them, but Matt Wagner has got a real love, apparently, of the shadow and that kind of genre. Which is not surprising. I mean, he's given like what he did for DC. A lot of his work has kind of... he's definitely done some other stuff that has that theme or that tone to it of the like pulp era, you know, with Sandman Mystery Theater especially.
Yeah. I'm getting sucked into the pulp world right now. Like, you know how I go through phases?
Yeah.
I was in a Legion phase just a couple weeks ago, and now I'm in like this pulp phase. But man, I'm loving like Black Bat and Miss Fury and all of that stuff. Like, I'm just getting sucked into the world.
Yeah. No, I definitely go through phases too. Either that or I'm full of shit. Like, I mean, I just said, speaking of filling in for you, I mean, I know I mentioned DC Noise that I hadn't read a new Marvel or anything new from Marvel or DC for like 4 months, but lately I've been reading a bunch of new Marvel, so.
But you know what? That's going to invigorate you to like it more. See, it's those little pauses so nothing gets stale on you. Do you know what I mean? That's what makes comics wonderful. They're all kind of good. It's just sometimes your mind says, I've seen this, I'm seeing this, and you get in the mode where you're just reading it on instinct. But if you take a break like I do, I read what I feel like reading, unless it's Kirby, like that's guaranteed. Like I could pick that up. You could tell me, pick up this and read it, and I'm going to read it, and I'm going to love it. For one thing, my mind is already in a biased mode. Like I just love his artwork, and I'm even learning to like his old artwork that doesn't look like the Kirby that, you know, the Fourth World Kirby.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like finding things that I think are spectacular in different phases. So,
yeah.
But we'll talk about that soon.
Mm-hmm. No, I think that's a good idea. I think that's one of the benefits of this show is, I think not only if you switch around in genre or style with current comics, but also having that reminder to go back and read things from different eras, you're not going to only get a different style or genre, but you're also going to get a different, probably going to get a different approach to making comics, you know?
Oh, yeah.
Art and writing, you know? Even if that's just the fact that there's thought balloons.
Yeah. Well, in reading a lot of the old Legion, I'm going to talk about Legion Lost a little bit because I started the new hardcover. But mm-hmm. I'm discovering things that make me appreciate the newer material even more. Like, there's things that are said and relationships that are built that I didn't know existed before, you know?
Yeah.
And there's so much history and continuity there that I'm like, wow, this is awesome.
Yeah, and it might not even be, like you said, there's on the one hand, you have issues of maybe being able to appreciate allusions to continuity and things that happen in the character's past, and then you also, on top of it, can get deeper appreciation just from the history of artistry and writing, you know.
Right, or appreciation from the creators saying, wow, they actually researched this.
Yeah.
Like, this character really did appear.
Right. Yeah, and like, for example, with reading the Fourth World Saga, you know, every once in a while I think maybe Final Crisis will make more sense, you know?
Oh, yeah.
You
just,
know?
Just this last story arcs that we just read, I can't remember if it was the Forever People. I think it was the Forever People I was reading.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, some of the things that I disliked about Grant Morrison's writing are starting to make sense. I mean,
mm-hmm.
what he did with the Omega Beams and all that stuff happened to the Forever People, you know?
Yeah. Not only Final Crisis, but I think his Batman run, too, could kind
yeah,
of...
Well, yeah, his yeah. Rest in Peace, where he actually killed him.
Be of a piece with... I think a lot of the Fourth World stuff was pretty strong in his mind when he was plotting all that out, and it's just
yeah.
It's so condensed. You know, being Grant Morrison doesn't really spell anything out for the reader. So it's kind of up to you if you want to take the time to sort of decipher it. And I think some of it is dependent upon having a knowledge of the things that he was influenced by. And I think a lot of that is in the Fourth World, it seems.
Oh, yeah. Sunny Sumu. And I even think that Japanese team he created in Final Crisis was Kirby inspired.
Probably,
in some indirect... I mean, I know it was anime-inspired and inspired by their, you know, culture, just by their names and stuff, but just their mannerisms and stuff and the way he created them seem inspired by Kirby.
Yeah, it's definitely not a, you know, one-to-one kind of thing. In some cases, he's obviously taken influence from other places. I mean, whether you like him or not, you know, he's a talented guy. He's definitely an intelligent guy. So he's going to be drawing some influences, you know, from other places. But I think he definitely saw Final Crisis as something that was connected directly in a lot of ways to Kirby's work, you know?
Yeah.
It's kind of a tribute in some ways, some interesting ways. But...
And then Micah's fault... I was listening to... I haven't finished listening to it yet, but I was listening to Geek Brunch.
Mm.
It's kind of refreshing to listen to a podcast you're part of and not be in it. Because I don't usually listen to myself, but...
Right.
Because I'm already in the discussion. So it's
yeah.
Like, how I'm going to edit it. I'll only listen to the parts where I need to make breaks in the episode or whatever.
Yeah.
Or if I need to edit it out, but... It was refreshing to hear that, you know, Micah talk about Black Panther because that's some awesome shit with the gold toads and everything that he was talking about. I'm like, he got me remembering that, and I want to revisit that.
Yeah.
He got me, like, excited to revisit some of his Marvel stuff. And I'm making my way through Devil Dinosaur, which I don't find the story is rich as what we're reading here, but... The art is very rich and very Kirby-esque.
Yeah, that's around the same time, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, it cracked me up that of all the times that Micah read some Kirby was when you were going to be on the show. And then they were asking some kind of question, and Bill called me a Kirby expert. I'm like, no, I'm the understudy.
You will be soon. You're going to be like... an expert because you're taking the journey throughout.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah, I'm studying.
Yeah, it's good definitely stuff to study. Thing. That's for sure.
Mm-hmm.
I do tend to like his work better when he's doing both art and writing.
Mm-hmm.
I do notice a difference.
Yeah.
In my enjoyment of the story.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, that's awesome.
Well, that seems like a pretty good segue, really, if you want to start off with that.
Sure.
Might as well at this point.
Man, did I love the New Gods issue. God, that was my favorite. because basically told you everything you needed to know. I mean, it's definitely more serious. And Superman's pal is definitely the most fun, like just out there for me.
Mm-hmm.
And the Forever People, I learned a hell of a lot. So, but we're just gonna start with Forever People number 7, and it was a 25-cent comic, I think, from 1973, and it continues when Darkseid. It's cool how you can read this, like. I forgot a lot, but I read a few pages and then I remembered exactly where we were left off. Do you know what I mean?
Yep.
It's like I didn't have to go pull out the other book or anything. I remembered exactly where we left off, and I'm like, hey, yeah, they got blasted by the Omega Beans, and Seraphim was like, I'm left here alone with the Super Cycle. He's being attacked by Gilbert, what's his name, Godfrey?
It's
a comedian.
That's the dude from, yeah.
What is his name?
Glorious.
Glorious Godfrey. I guess Gilbert Godfrey would be a good character actor for him.
I don't know. Yeah, maybe if this was done, in the 90s, they would have put him instead of Don Rickles.
Yeah, because he is over the top.
Yeah, because he's got that really crazy voice.
But that's where we left off, and I guess some younger gods are asking for High Father's help.
Yeah, they're kind of like the Forever People's buddies. We get I don't know if we really understood prior to this that the High Father was just kind of wanting to maintain peace, and in a lot of ways, the Forever People kind of had gone off in the adventures that we've been following them in so far. They've been sort of doing so without the High Father's permission. And what they're doing is probably necessary, but it's not as if they're on a officially sanctioned mission, so to speak.
Yeah, he's not happy about it.
And I think once we get to New Gods, we get a pretty good sense of where he's coming from.
Mm-hmm.
We understand a lot more about who he is and stuff. But the Forever People are unstuck in time, kind of, or at least they've been sent to various periods in history. And the first one that we get is Moon Rider and Beautiful Dreamer. In the Civil War era, they are at Ford's Theater right before Lincoln is about to be assassinated.
Yeah, this is by far the most one that I'm aware of the situations that happen. Well, Ponce de Leon I'm aware of too, but the one in the with the Romans, I wasn't quite sure in history when that actually took place. He draws good animals and stuff, though. And even the suits and dresses and stuff, are very well done. I don't know how much research he did. I don't think he probably did a heck of a lot because he's drawing so many damn pages a month, but
right.
He was very effective doing what he needed to do.
Yeah, I think he got enough of it right to. So it's just to be specific, Viken the Black ends up, like you said, Ponce de Leon. So this would be like South America, right? Florida.
Florida. Yeah. It's the Fountain of Youth and stuff.
Right, right. And Big Bear. Big Bear's the one that ends up in medieval. Britain.
Yeah, which is a period of history I know like not much about, like how the Romans conquered Britain, but it seems like it did have like historical significance because he was trying to prevent these barbarians from attacking the Romans because they were withdrawing, it seems like.
Yeah, I can't say real specifically, but I'm assuming that this is probably when the Roman Empire was starting to draw back a little bit.
Yeah.
You know, from being all over Europe and had extended itself a little bit too far to maintain control. But yeah, Big Bear, he's a student of history, so he's pretty interested in just maintaining the status quo. He doesn't want to change history, he just wants to witness it.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously the people that are there, it's not history for them. They're in their own given circumstances, so they want his help. But he doesn't want to give it just for the sake of preserving history.
Because he's the only one that seems competent about history. Like, they even Moonrider and Beautiful Dreamer are like, wish we had Big Bear because he knows his history.
Right.
And they try to change history. Those two.
Yeah, I liked that. They do kind of catch on to the fact of where they are after a little bit. So they have every intention to help the assassination. And I like that you kind of see that coming. Like, maybe this is going to be a story about how they alter history and you know, they disappear from the time period right at that time, because I don't think we mentioned that Highfather is convinced to rescue the Forever People, so he sends out alpha bullets, which can traverse time and space and find their targets with accuracy. And once they strike, you know, they're able to, you know, restore the Forever People to where they had been before Darkseid sent them into different periods of time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was interesting too how, like, Ponce de Leon is calling him they're calling him Black before he even introduced himself. And then his name is Viking the Black. It's like they're almost calling him by the last name, but just because he's Black.
Yeah. Yeah, I thought that was almost kind of like a... Or, I mean, I took when them calling him the Black...
I have to go back and see if he said, this is my name, and they just called him the Black, but they basically start off calling him the Black before he even says who he is.
Which I just took that as kind of racism or something on their part. But yeah, I have the page open, and he pops up, and the first thing they say is, "Seize the Black."
Mm-hmm.
But it was a fun issue, enjoyable. I don't know, you know, there wasn't a lot of plot development, and in the sense that in the overall saga, it's really just kind of, you know, we do get a good sense of the Forever People and their status as far as how the High Father views them and how they get out of the situation that they're in. But I'd say the most significant page probably is the last one, where we find out what happened to Sonny Sumo.
Mm-hmm.
So Seraphin heads to Japan and discovers that there's a mother box in an ancient temple, and the monk that has been guarding it hands it over to Seraphin because he had been told, it had been told a long time ago that this mother box would be claimed by a forever somebody from the Forever People, and they actually have a huge mural of Sonny Sumo. So it's one of those things where he was sent into the past and became famous, and he sent the mother box basically down through time, and it was passed down generation to generation so that it would get back to the Forever People. The monk says that he's remembered as a wise man, an athlete, and a farmer, and he lived his life out among the poor who loved him.
Yeah, that was pretty cool. The other panel that I really enjoyed in this is it shows like how Highfather is the counter to Darkseid when he in the one panel where he kind of lifts his hand and shoots the alpha bullets. So he was actually Darkseid sent him in the past. He brought him back. I really like that panel. Because they like counter each other. It's like matter and antimatter.
That's true, yeah. Yeah, it definitely foreshadows the next issue of New Gods.
Mm-hmm. So we get a two-page Lonar, and the interesting thing is here is he runs across Orion, and it tells you like the foreshadowing that he might be evil because the horse freaks out on him.
Yeah, and it's interesting to see him in such a sort of barbaric status. You know, he's just kind of he's just got red underpants on and boots, and he's just kind of hanging out in the in the wilderness beneath the beneath the New Genesis floating city.
Right. It's crazy because every time I read these, I think I like them even more. Like even just analyzing them. Because when you read it, you're reading it the first time just like a regular comic. And then when you're analyzing it, when we discuss it, there's a lot of things in there to appreciate.
Yeah, the one thing I thought kind of cool about this little story was just that Lonar's horse that he calls Thunderer.
I know what you're getting to, I think.
He actually got him from the ruins of the old gods.
Oh, yeah, that is true.
So, you know, and I think...
If you dig in the Thor, maybe there is a horse.
Yeah, I was wondering, or just like in Norse mythology, you know, if this is supposed to be a specific horse, or if it's just the fact that it is a horse and there's not a lot of animals around anymore, it seems.
Or maybe that's where he got Thundar the Barbarian.
Yeah.
This is Thunderer, but he helped create Thundar the Barbarian, so... That's pretty awesome. That's cool. The other thing that I just want to mention, because it is Kirby related, is I got to talk to Tom Scholey the first day of the con. And he always goes through the vendor boxes like because he gets in there early. And he had found a Golden Age comic of Boys Ranch. Is a Kirby comic written in, I think it was written and drawn by him, and it is pretty freaking awesome. The only thing he says is smell it. It smells kind of stinky. You know, smell our comics, and it smelled like there was a little bit of water damage at one point, or humidity damage to it. It didn't look damaged on paper, like if you're staring at it, but it did have like a weird smell to it. He's like, smell it. That doesn't smell too good. Yeah, this I thought the Forever People was my least favorite, but of the three, but it's still like top notch. They're all 5 out of 5s for me, but I like them all for different reasons. I like this one for because you got to see the Omega Beams, the effects of the Mega Beams, and then the countermeasure to how they got back. I really like it. And
I would say it's probably a least favorite. Not in that it's bad. Just that the other two are so strong.
Yeah. Superman's Pal, I think, overall, is the most fun because. You have the Newsboy Legion, which I think are always written very humorous. I love Scrapper Trooper, and I love Scrapper. I mean, everything that he says out of his mouth kind of makes me chuckle a little bit. And the fact that he's on an adventure with Scrapper Trooper in this. But this is Superman's Pal, Jimmy Olsen, number 146. And it has a primitive Jimmy Olsen on the cover throwing an object at the Newsboy Legion. And Brainy is saying, stand back, Superman. Jimmy has turned him into a caveman, and he's stronger than a wild bull. He'll destroy you.
Yeah, I agree that this title is definitely the place for the most humorous and goofy situations.
And I find Makari and Simeon to be, God, like those evil scientists that are... It doesn't even seem like they care about like Darkseid's mission, but they care about science and they're just along for the ride. Like, and they're always being foiled at some level, and it's funny. I find it funny.
Yeah, they're immoral in the sense that they're gonna do the science experiments regardless of whether it's ethical or not. But you know, their ambition is particularly focused on science. It's not as if they're trying to take over the world or anything. They just want to follow their ambitions in science experiments, you know.
And it kind of like made me laugh a little bit because here they're the ones that that shifted Olsen back, you know, to a caveman, and then they're like kind of like, oh shit, what the hell? He's destroying everything. They're like, oh, what did we do that for?
Yeah, they'll follow their experiments with disregard to even their own safety.
It's like, damn, he's destroying our whole place. They kind of did it to themselves.
Yeah, and Makari pisses Simeon off a little bit because he points out that Simeon looks a little bit like a caveman himself.
It is really funny, and I don't know if he intended it to be as funny as it is, but it's really well executed funny.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I loved it. And they kind of blast him with the ray, which knocks him out temporarily. It paralyzes him, but little do they know that Scrapper Trooper and Scrapper got out of the trap, and they're here to free Jimmy.
And I love so much that now they're the same size, Scrapper and Scrapper Trooper.
Yeah, yeah.
So they're just two Scrappers running around together, but one's dressed and trained differently, you know? So it's just like he's really now, instead of just carrying himself in his own pocket, he's teamed up with himself pretty much.
Right. But
I like that. For some reason, it really amuses me that that Scrapper Trooper doesn't have an accent.
Yeah, it is weird.
Which I don't know if I ever noticed that until this issue. But I like that.
Because he doesn't really save much. He's in his pocket. But you're getting...
Right, yeah. Well, he talks a lot more here. And it makes kind of sense. It's not like he was raised where Scrapper was. He was cloned and raised in a vault, so he would just speak, you know, English without however he was taught it, you know?
Right.
So I like that little touch.
Yeah, so did I. And I think Kirby draws the most beautiful woman in comics. He drew Terry Dean in here, which they had there, you know. Superman was at the last time we saw them, they were at that like musical play that she was hosting, right? Where those evil
apocalyptic
band that looked like the Beatles kind of were playing.
Yeah.
And
those guys were awesome.
Yeah. They had found a trapdoor, so Guardian went down the trapdoor to see if he could find anything. And we're learning a little bit about Duplex. Dublex is powers and how they're manifesting themselves.
Yeah, he's the purple guy with the yellow horns. And I like that I like that, you know, Miss Dean here is she's just wearing, you know, like a black and white striped tank top, and one of the first things that Dublex does is like flip her upside down. But yeah, thanks for that recap, because if anything, out of everything, I was pretty much remembering everything, but I did kind of forget what preceded this particular scene, what these guys were doing, because the Guardian is the one I think that accompanied Superman, right, to the party.
Yeah, yeah.
And he pops up and reports on what he found in the tunnels beneath the place.
Not a lot of Superman in this issue. He basically reports back, and then Superman goes in the tunnels to look for stuff. And then that's it. You don't see any more of Superman.
Yeah, it's true.
But that's okay, because all the other part of the story is more interesting anyway, I think.
No, and I will say I like how Superman pretty much just plays the, you know, the straight man throughout this.
Yeah.
And as if it's like a comedy duo with, and you have like your straight man. He's just the, even though he technically is an alien as well, I mean, he just is kind of at the center of all this craziness. You kind of need that one character that's just normal.
Yeah, and it makes him look normal because of all the other weird stuff that's going on.
Yeah, he definitely, it's a good choice for him, for a role for him to play.
Yeah. And the other Newsboy Legion are in their whiz wagon, and they're blasting through the evil factory. And they get blasted by a device that actually puts them to a standstill and kind of knocks them all out.
And yeah, device Mokari and Simeon use on them.
Yeah, and they have plans to burn them or send them into the furnace.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it sets everybody but Scrapper and Scrapper Trooper. Do you remember how they got separated? Why Scrapper and Scrapper Trooper are separate?
I think they were separate, and they got miniaturized first, and then I think the Whiz Wagon went in afterwards. After they went in, I don't remember why they were separated.
Okay.
But we get to see a lot of cool Kirby monsters, because as Scrapper Trooper and Scrapper are trying to save Jimmy Olsen, who's still paralyzed, they're going through this area of the evil factory where all these monsters are kept, like dinosaurs and prehistoric monsters. And Jimmy Olsen, prehistoric Jimmy, wakes up and starts going after Scrapper and the Scrapper Trooper. And he starts destroying things, and he actually destroys the vehicle that they're riding in. And Sabretooth Tiger and tends to beat the saber-toothed tiger out, kind of like pounces him until knocks him out, or kills him. I don't know.
Yeah, because they're trying to rescue him, so they're driving this kind of golf cart type thing with the knocked out Jimmy on the back of it. So yeah, when he throws when he picks up and throws their vehicle, it crashes into one of the electrified cages. That's how the saber-toothed tiger gets out. But, and then Olsen walks into the cage the tiger came out of and grabs its raw steak. It's pretty hilarious. You there?
I'm here.
Oh, okay.
I went mute because my phone was ringing.
Ah, okay. Didn't know if I lost you to the saber-toothed tiger.
No, I was actually responding, and I realized I was still on mute because the phone was ringing.
But yeah, I like the little touch, that little detail that Olsen goes after the tiger's steak.
Yeah, that's funny.
But so yeah, the Whiz Wagon is just about to end up in the furnace, and thankfully Flipper Dippa wakes up and tries to take control of the Whiz Wagon and stop it from entering it, but he can't get the car under control, so he drops a concussion bomb that's loaded into the undercarriage of the vehicle, and that's enough to blast them free of the track and send them kind of, it looks like they just go off track and crash through a wall.
Yeah. And then they're like going to hit some of the evil factory workers, I take it. But they're having trouble like guiding their whiz wagon through the narrow corridors.
Yeah, so there's like a basically the damage that releases the saber-tooth tiger eventually ends up short-circuiting all the cages. Because you can see from the drawing earlier that what's keeping them in is basically not bars, but electric charges. So Olsen jumps on the back of a woolly mammoth and is holding kind of a club of sorts. So Scrapper and the Scrapper Trooper get on their own animals to so they don't get stampeded. And then are able to get rescued by the other Legion guys on the whiz wagon, and they follow follow Olsen and the stampede of animals toward
Simeon and Makari, who are trying to shut the door. Close the door, the titanium doors, and they don't successfully close the door because Jimmy comes through the door and he stops he puts his weapon or whatever his staff is right into the middle of the doors so he can squeeze through, and he tends to destroy every piece of equipment that they possibly have.
Yeah, he doesn't so much, at least not immediately, attack Simeon and Makari as he does just kind of start smashing things and kicking and breaking everything nearby.
And it looks like he somehow, and the blast may have turned back to Jimmy Olsen, but we'll have to see.
Yeah, there's a sense that something's happening to him, and then all we see is we know that he's still alive. We see him laying face down in the grass, and you can kind of see that he might be normal-sized again. You know, when in his caveman look, he's got super long hair. It looks like his hair might be short, normal again. And the whiz wagon is kind of crashed into a hillside, but they're alive as well. And there's a huge crater where the evil factory used to be.
It's kind of interesting on his choice not to leave it on the cliffhanger like they might be dead.
Yeah.
Because there's no indication of life in the drawing. He verbally tells you, you know, here's Jimmy, he's breathing and living, and then the wagon, you don't see any bodies or anything, you just know it's crashed, and he says, and they too have survived.
I wonder if that's a comics code thing.
I don't know. I think they would have let him cliffhanger it.
Yeah. That's a good question.
This other thing is very interesting. This RN, the armored man, who I don't think I've ever seen before. He's got Superman cell tissue in space. That's interesting.
That was like kind of the main thing about it that I found. This is another like two-page DNA project story, and it's a scientist, Professor Packard, and this Aaron the Armored Man that looks like a bulky, darker Silver Surfer in some ways.
Right.
The first page is just basically the professor and Aaron saying goodbye. Packard seems to have thought of him as a son at this point.
Right. He's his experiment, but at the same time, I think he considers him like somebody he cares about, and they do the Spock and Captain Kirk thing through the window.
Yeah.
Way before Spock and Captain Kirk did it.
That's true. I take that to mean that Kirby basically invented Star Trek, right?
Yeah, I think so.
Daryl like that idea. But Iron seems to have been created for a specific task. He's racketed into outer space, and he's got a metal container on his back, but it's not, you know, life support or anything. It's a container that contains Superman's cell tissue and genetic code.
I am very curious to see where this goes, or if it goes anywhere. Because it might have been a vision that never completed. I don't know.
Yeah, seriously, if Kirby doesn't do anything with it and no one's ever picked up and used that for something, I'd be shocked. I mean,
yeah.
So that's something juicy that could be. It's probably been picked up in somewhere, but yeah, I guess obviously the DNA project had Superman's information, and I guess this is how they wanted to get it, try to get it away from any enemies who might want to get their hands on it. Do you know how that always works out?
I have the, I don't know if you could hear the background. Can you hear the background?
I thought I just heard something.
We've been having sirens go by. I don't know why they're going by, but there's a lot of them going by. Maybe it's for the fire. I don't know. But
yeah.
The chihuahuas next door, they go nuts after the fire truck goes by or whatever is going by.
I think that's what I heard.
It sounds like they're getting beaten, but they just... just start yelping like loud. Yeah, this was a really good issue. The next one is my favorite, but I think it was because historically, I knew what was there. Like I knew what they were getting at because we all know the origin of, you know, Scott Free and Orion. But to see it again and read it again was pretty freaking awesome. And this tells you a lot about Highfather and why he's the way he is and how Darkseid came into power, essentially.
Pretty much, yeah.
It is really awesome. And the artwork in this one is by far the best. And I think Mentron's an asshole. I really do. He's very much like Simeon and Makari, except he's a god. I don't think he so much understands bad or you know, good or evil. I think he's just in it for himself, like to try to achieve the most knowledge he possibly can about everything. And he doesn't care how it happens.
Yeah, he seems really neutral except for apart from his own self-interest, you know.
Yeah.
I wouldn't say he's like 100% neutral because he has his own fascinations. But we've known that about him prior to this issue, but I think that this gives us we learn how far he's willing to go to and really how, you know, deep that goes, his lack of concern for just about anything other than his own pursuit of knowledge, you know. He really doesn't have an allegiance, and as a result, it doesn't seem like anybody trusts him,
mm-hmm.
you know, with good reason. But, yeah, I didn't know, you know, that, you know, it opens on a page of two New Genesis people, Isaiah, the Inheritor, and his wife Avia, and they're in a, you know, having a pretty, I was gonna say happy time, but then I realized that might sound like the issue starts off with them humping. But they're just kind of enjoying each other's company.
It's like a lover's picnic
in a clothed manner.
yeah.
But not looking at it now, I didn't when I opened this issue. I didn't know that this guy was Highfather.
And I did.
I'm surprised I didn't just looking at him.
Because they call his name a lot. I mean, there's certain people that call him Isaiah.
But is that after the fact? I don't know if we've seen that too much in the...
I don't think we've seen it to date. I'm just talking about, like...
Later on
in comics, yeah.
Yeah. Some of that stuff I have... And some of that stuff I haven't read, so... You know, like, I knew the stuff about Scott Free and you know, what's his face? Orion. Yeah, basically this is, you know, their picnic or whatever they're doing is interrupted quickly by Steppenwolf and his troopers.
Who's the uncle to Darkseid.
Yeah. Yeah, and Darkseid is there. He's kind of kept in the shadows at first. He's saying, you know, there's someone saying, "Careful, uncle," in the background, and urging caution. But we don't see that is actually Darkseid for a couple pages. And I like the way that, you know, that Kirby framed this. Like, we see basically Darkseid do something before we look to the next panel and find out it is him.
Yeah.
You know, Steppenwolf wants to duel Highfather, but we see a yellow mechanical hand come in and this nephew of Steppenwolf saying, "This is the way. It's best to finish this enemy quickly and leave this place." And we look to the next panel and there's Darkseid using that device. So I like that sequencing, you know. It's, mm-hmm. you know, knowing that we know who Darkseid is, but at this point, you know, haven't seen much of his history or background. That was a cool direction, I would call it.
Yeah, it is. And he killed Avia.
Mm-hmm.
So it tells you, you know, why he's so pissed in this issue.
Yeah, Steppenwolf shoots her.
Yeah, she's her design is absolutely gorgeous. I love her design.
Yeah, her costume is really cool. And whatever you want to call it, in her headpiece. But yeah, the killing glove, the thing that Darkseid used on him, we're told was designed by his good friend Assad.
Mm-hmm.
I like that Steppenwolf remarks that it's interesting that Assad created something that would kill someone so quickly, considering that he likes to torture, basically.
Yeah. So at the end of page 5, you think that they're both dead.
Yeah.
But it said I don't know how to pronounce it, but Isaya is still alive. He goes through the point to say, like, even though they could be dead, that they're alive. And then you get the pact, and you see a splash page where the new gods are invading Apocalypse. And that's a really cool design because it has like two warriors carrying this huge box, and it's kind of blasting everything. And parademons are like, "Oh shit, open fire."
Yeah, this is a pretty cool, you know, the way that it flows. We've got a few pages that basically give us, you know, that are kind of like a prologue, give us the precursor, tell us what led to these two worlds going to war, and then we flip the page and it's a real impactful double page spread showing us that war occurring.
And it's cool because they like have like their own atom bomb and they drop it into the fire pit and it puts it out.
Mm-hmm.
At least one of the fire pits. It's a pretty awesome scene. And then you're having dinner with Darkseid, Desaad, Steppenwolf, and Hegra, who I think this is her first appearance. I don't remember seeing her before, and she's the mom of Darkseid, I think.
Yeah, this is Steppenwolf's sister and Darkseid's mom. Darkseid's mama.
Mm-hmm. and he starts talking about this box, and is this like the the technology that brings the boom tubes to life? That box that he that shows vanishing and then coming back?
I think
or
so.
Or is it Mother Box?
No, I think it's No, I think it's a precursor to
the boom tubes.
Yeah, Metron shows up because it's called the X element, and Metron wants it because this is actually before Metron has built his chair.
Yeah,
and that's what he is really his goal right now is to build that, so that he can, you know, he can travel and appear and reappear throughout time and space, so that he can kind of. His goal is to, you know, do his exploration and learn what he wants to learn.
But also give Darkseid that technology. And you can see why Darkseid's using him, because he wants that technology to go find whatever, you know, the anti-life equation, I bet.
Mm-hmm.
So he's already a visionary, and he's already plotting. And he knows, he already knows that Mentron's going to betray him.
Right.
He said he flat out tells him, "You'll betray us all in time."
Mm-hmm.
But this he's thing just built for us, yeah.
Yeah, he's using them for his own. They're using each other. I like that Darkseid stops Metron for leaving without paying his respects to his mom.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it's neat. I don't know. I like the novelty of seeing all these villains just kind of chilling, eating dinner.
Right.
That we've already we've not seen them in such a normal situation, you know. But yeah, a lot of this concerns, you know, the war, the breakout of war between these two planets, New Genesis and Apocalypse, and it's the first time, really, you know, so this is prior to the boom tomb technology, but it is the first time that using this X-Matter, Apocalypse is able to just instantly transport, without any warning, you know, weaponry onto New Genesis and attack them with surprise. So they do that with these dragon tanks. So like mechanical dragons on wheels.
Those are freaking awesome.
Yeah, they're cool.
And even these guys, like the new god's spears that they're throwing, or that he throws, that's pretty cool. And their guns.
Destructibles.
Awesome. Yeah, that's awesome. And they're riding like these huge dogs. Like they might be the hunger dogs that they call. Steppenwolf is riding them in.
Yeah,
and the design of this one character, who they don't say, who's from New Genesis, that has like the gun fist, is freaking awesome looking.
Looks kind of like Galactus.
Yeah, it does.
The it's almost like it seems as if there it's almost kind of like a New Genesis like infantry uniform.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so obviously it's not size-wise like Galactus with the blue and purple the helmets that they're wearing. Well, there's only really one that you see, and then in the foreground there's the face of one who seems to have a somewhat similar helmet, a little bit different, but yeah, his arm seems to be his gun. But it looks like it's a pretty devastating war. Both sides are taking a lot of damage, it looks like.
Yeah, but then Isaiah shows up and kills Steppenwolf.
Yeah, he pops up in armor that we haven't seen before, and he's masked, so Steppenwolf doesn't immediately recognize him. And that blow to the Apocalypse's forces, having Steppenwolf killed, causes them to retreat. So, and once again, now communicating with the opposite side, Metron shows up and has a conversation with Isaiah. who at this point, you know, Isaiah knows of Darkseid, but doesn't, and has his suspicions, but
he doesn't know how, like, he's running things behind the scenes, or he's climbing up the ranks.
Yeah, Metron confirms that Darkseid's making his move and is going to be, you know, kind of, you know, wresting control, really. And immediately we see there's a planetoid start raining down from the sky onto New Genesis, and we see like Darkseid's whole thing is that he wants to use technology, and he's willing to. We get the sense that Steppenwolf was kind of a attack first and think later, whereas Kirby portrays Darkseid as more of a thinker and a planner.
Yeah, everything he does is well thought out. Steppenwolf is just jump into the. And I wonder if Darkseid even knew, like, if Steppenwolf's dead, then, hey, it's mine to take.
I don't know if I was just assuming that, or if there's something that implies that, but that's kind of how I was thinking of it.
Mm-hmm. Because he's a plotter.
Yeah.
He, like, knew what was going to happen. Because I even think he might have not. He, like, purposely might have pulled the glove early to not kill. I mean, maybe I'm reading too much into this, but maybe he purposely didn't kill him because he wanted him to kill Steppenwolf.
Hmm. I could certainly see that. I definitely assumed that he was willing to see his uncle unnecessarily risk his life, and because it's interesting, like when they're attacking, Steppenwolf says, "Praise young Darkseid for yielding this command to me. This is where a lusty warrior should be." And you know, I wouldn't be surprised, and I kind of assume that that Darkseid was more than happy to let his uncle take the risk, and knowing that it might be likely, because basically, I mean, like Steppenwolf, that it'd be likely that he died, because Steppenwolf shows up, they do some damage, but it's really Darkseid has his own plan, and he holds back his heavy attack until Steppenwolf is killed. So it's almost like he's waiting for his uncle to get eliminated and put out of the way before he sends in his real attack.
And then it shows Highfather creating the source wall.
Yeah, because
like the wall's already there, but he's like, "I am the inheritor. What is my inheritance?" And then he slams his staff down, and then all of a sudden you have the source wall.
Yeah, and there's an important, I think, as far as his character goes. I mean, the battle escalates to such a point that he realized. He's not becoming. He's become something other than himself. He's been in wanting revenge. He's become like Darkseid, and he keeps asking, "Where is Isaiah?" You know, obviously meaning, I'm not myself anymore, and we're worse than the old gods. You know, they destroyed themselves with their these new gods. Him among them are on the way to destroy everything, not just themselves. And so he starts tearing off his armor and looking basically to find himself. And it's in this sort of like existential agony that he's in that he discovers the source wall.
Mm-hmm.
So this is the moment of transformation from Isaiah to the High Father.
Yep. And it's like Darkseid knew this all along. Because he's already. As soon as this happens, Darkseid's already willing to make peace with New Genesis so he could give each other the trade the suns. He's going to trade Orion for Scott Free to make this peace pact, and his wife, Tiger, is just going nuts.
Yeah, it's a neat... I like how they chose to... Kirby chose to jump time a little bit here. And, you know, Tiger's freaking out because Darkseid is giving away their son, like you said.
And it's kind of cool because... You almost think that, like, a lot of the crazy... You know how, like, Orion's got, like, two faces?
Mm-hmm.
Like, one where he's kind of in control and one where he's wild? It's like he almost gets the wild side from his mom.
Because
Darkseid even say he's like you, a fighting, snarling, killer cat.
Oh, true. Yeah. Yeah, it's...
And it's so awesome because Tiger says, it won't work, Darkseid. He'll live, he'll grow, and he'll kill you. That gave me goosebumps. I'm like, ah, shit.
A lot of this stuff is so Shakespearean, you know?
Yeah, it was great.
And, you know, it is a cool warning. Like, you know, you send your son away, he's going to grow up and come back for you.
Mm-hmm.
And, so, you know, but they get Scott Free, and...
Granny Goodness names him Scott Free. Such a great name. Like, I'm going to get off Scott Free.
Yeah, you know, and I don't know if he planned this from the beginning, but even if he didn't, this is a really clever way of... Because as soon as you read that name, you're like, really? Like, he's an escape artist, and his name's Scott Free?
Uh-huh.
But this is a perfect way of having it, you know, not just be a joke, and that Granny Goodness, you know, names him that as a pun on the fact that Darkseid says, you know, really from the beginning, they planned to let Scott Free go eventually, because the only reason that Darkseid is doing this is because he wants time. He knows he's not ready to really accomplish his goals. So he doesn't really want peace. He just wants peace for a time so that he can build his forces. Whereas Highfather, you know, wants peace for forever.
Right. He doesn't want war.
Yeah. So they make this pact. But right from this very beginning, Darkseid is eventually planning to break that pact. But to break it by letting Scott Free escape, quote unquote. He may conveniently decide to escape from Apocalypse Granny. Of course, on that day, the pact I agreed to will be broken. And Granny says, "That fine day will be dear to your heart, sire. Therefore, in its honor, I shall name the lad Scott Free." And then she laughs. And I just thought that was really brilliant because not only is there a reason for his name being called that, except for instead of it just being a silly, you know, kind of pun on his... superhero identity.
Yeah.
It's tied into the entire plot.
And that's why I think Entertainment Weekly's quote on the cover of this book is amazing, because I think they say it's richly complex. And it is. It is. This whole thing is very deep. I mean, there's so much here. We don't get this shit in our comics today. It takes them 2 years. This is only freaking 7 issues.
I know.
It's rich. The content is every freaking issue we get introduced to something new and a character that was stole, you know, withheld the test of time.
Yeah.
And it's awesome because the parademons they're trying to drag Orion into, and he's like, "Don't let me go like he doesn't want to go,
right?
And they send him through, and then there's Highfather, and he like takes a blade to Highfather, and he's like, "You're not my father," and he calms him down.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, his instinct is to kill Highfather, and you know, he gives them the choice. Either, you know, take my hand.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, either drop the weapon and take my hand or use the weapon. and you have the decision. And so he says, all right, well, he drops the weapon and says, you know, I'll trust you for now.
Yeah, you speak to my liking, I'll trust you.
Yeah.
But it's, he goes there and he said, I was told I'd find my father here. If you're my father, speak. You won't speak to me, you'll never speak to me. I hate you, hate me, you hate me. So he doesn't even know that, like, Darkseid's his real father.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and he kind of, Highfather answers him, but doesn't answer him. You know, he says, you're my father, and Highfather just says, only if you wish me to be.
Whereas Scott Free looks more like a baby, like, I don't know, maybe one or two, with a lot of hair.
Yeah.
Because of the way they're holding him.
Right.
Orion looks like he's a kid that's like 7 or 8.
Yeah.
You know, with a lot of anger management problems.
Anger management problems and old man eyebrows. His eyebrows are huge.
He gets them from his mom.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, I guess so.
She's got evil eyebrows, but they're more feminine.
That's true. They're pretty significant.
But you can see where the hair color comes from.
That's true, yeah. Yeah, his eyebrows look like her hair.
Yeah.
That's pretty awesome.
Brilliant issue.
Yeah, I love this issue. It's amazing.
Yeah, there's so much to love. My favorite scene is still with the scene with Tigra and Darkseid. That whole page is freaking amazing. There's so many amazing pages in here. Even the Highfather when he does the source wall like you were talking about.
Mm-hmm.
It's good stuff. And then we get a 2-page Viking the Black story, which is kind of a done in one in 2 pages.
Yeah, there's not a lot to it. Maybe it was just because it was after such an epic issue where so much happened. It just seemed like a throw-in, kind of. There wasn't too much to it.
Yeah, it was great.
But, so next time we'll be getting back to Mr. Miracle with number 7 of that. And then we'll have Jimmy Olsen 147 and the Forever People number 8.
I get so into these that, like, I don't want to stop, but... Do you ever read ahead? Or do you
kind of
stay? We're
moving along. I've been kind of staying at pace. Like, sometimes the only thing I've done is immediately read the next 3 after we're done or something.
Uh-huh.
You know, but otherwise I've been kind of staying on pace.
Yeah, I'm staying on pace totally, but there's certain times when I hit, like, a certain note, like, I don't want to put it down. Like, it's hard. But I have so much stuff to read that I just keep marching.
Right, yeah. If I had nothing else to read, then I'd probably be done with the whole series, but...
Yeah.
But yeah, it's nice. It feels good to come back to it after a break.
Mm-hmm. With our little flash break.
Yeah, yeah. Like you said, keeps it fresh.
Yeah, it does.
But yeah, I even said on, when Michael was talking about Black Panther stuff, it's just amazing how much, at that point, having just gone through 2 of the 4 volumes, getting through half of it, just how much stuff has happened. Plot-wise, it's just, there's just been so many events and so much content.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Cool. So we only had 2 questions today. But one was from Vicious Smith that said, what is the strangest era of Superman for you? I'd have to say in the Silver Age, just because there were done-in-one stories and he was moving worlds and stuff. I mean, he was, like, super powerful, but it was strange, but it's strangely fun. The Kerry Bates issues of Superman.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's hard not to answer that period just because from a from a general standpoint, it's so unusual. Like, the storylines are so silly, I don't know, from a personal standpoint. I mean, I haven't read a lot of that stuff. Kara was just asking me yesterday if I've read a lot of Superman with the movie being out and everything, and I've read Superman stuff here and there. He's never been a favorite. He's never been my number one character or anything, you know?
He's definitely not my favorite, but the movie got it right, because the thing that makes Superman Superman is his willing to do good, his soul, his heart, and it's a story of fathers teaching their sons, and it's from two perspectives. You have Jor-El, who's got very little perspective in his life and is a recording to him, and then you got his father that taught him about humanity.
Right.
And then his mother, who grounds him into humanity, Ma Kent, and he didn't really know a lot about his other mother. But it's just rich, and the best Superman stories, in my opinion, they get that. If you get that right, and then if you get the supporting cast right, because he's so powerful, if you get the supporting cast right, it works. And I think that's why Superman's pal Jimmy Olsen works so well, is because you have a supporting cast that kind of carry the book, and he is the power, he's the icon behind everything that's going on. But yeah, I have every Superman comic since 1973, and while he's not my favorite, he's iconically one of my favorites.
Yeah, I do like the character, and for a number of reasons, for things that you just said. I definitely have an affection for Superman and aspects of the character, and I do like when he's sort of positioned as when there's a contrast played up between the fact that he's not human, but in a lot of ways he exemplifies what's best about humanity.
Yeah.
And I particularly like, my personal preference is for when, you know, the Kents are around. Depending on which origin story, you know, at times they've had the Kents around, sometimes they're passed away. I personally like to see him interacting with them. And with Pa Kent, I mean, even on the show, like, I didn't really keep up with Smallville as much after, spoilers for that show for some reason. You don't know at this point. But after the first few seasons, when after Pa Kent died, that was my favorite thing about the show, was the relationship between Clark
Yeah, even when Jeff Johns was writing it, when he did the issue with him and Pa Kent, like right before Jeff Johns killed him. There's something about it, like, that's magical. And my favorite parts of the movie of Superman of Steel none of the scenes were action scenes. None of them were like when he's fighting the characters or saving someone. My favorite scenes were when he was with Kevin Costner, who played Pa Kent, or his mom, Martha, or with Jor-El. Those were my favorite scenes. Mm-hmm. And even with his mother before they launched him to space, I actually loved those. And the flashback scene, there's one scene that they even show in the preview, and when you see it in the movie, it was executed so well that I was crying. Barb was like, "What are you?" I'm like, I had tears running down my face, and it's just, I don't know, there's something humbling and about his character and noble, and he's like Cap, Captain America, but he's got so much more power, and he's alien, but he believes in humanity, whereas Batman does not. He doesn't trust humanity.
Right.
And
he's the one that actually is human.
And the fact that they're friends and they respect and love each other, like Superman and Batman, is just freaking phenomenal. Like, I want to spoil Justice League of what is it, Justice League number 21 or number 20. But you're not reading current DC, right?
Right, and I actually read your Facebook update that had the spoiler warning because I'm not worried about spoilers right now.
But it is freaking phenomenal because Batman has always been like, I need to know everything about everybody that I possibly can to be the best that I am at what I do. But not only that, but have contingency plans for everybody. Mm-hmm. And we saw this when Mark Waid did his writing in pre-52, and now you're seeing it, you know, after this new 52. But he took Clark into his confidence and said, I have these boxes, and it has boxes for every member of the Justice League. And each box has a way, like Superman's box has kryptonite in it, but Superman gave it to him. But each box has a weakness for that character. And he handed Superman Wonder Woman's box, and he opens it. Superman says, it's empty. And his eyes just light up, and he says, God, this is fucking amazing. I'm getting excited talking about it right now. And he says, she has no weakness. You cannot take her. You're the only one that can take her out that I've identified, you know, there, she has no weakness right now. That's freaking amazing. And being a Wonder Woman fan that I am, I'm like, oh, shit. Oh, that was awesome.
Is that why that scene was so significant? Because as a Wonder Woman fan, that you appreciate that, you know, respect for her character? Or?
It was that because of so many things. It was that because of history of Batman, mm-hmm, and Superman. It was that because Superman is in a relationship with her.
Yeah.
And he gave him that box. That's the other significance of it that blew me away.
Mm-hmm.
And then Batman hands the box with the bat symbol to Superman. And he's like, I want you to keep this. And you don't know what's in the box.
Mm-hmm.
But he's essentially entrusting to Clark a way to kill him or mm-hmm take him out.
Right.
And God, that was so freaking powerful and such a great issue. I mean, even the supporting cast, like DCU's finally getting Firestorm right. It's almost like they said, man, that Ethan Van Sciver shit didn't work. And now we're getting back to the way Firestorm was and always will be, in my opinion.
Yeah, that seemed ill-advised. And I did read an issue of one of the last few issues before they canceled Firestorm.
Dan Jurgens made it feel a little bit more like
Dan Jurgens. Yeah, that's right. I think it might have been just too little too late. I wish, you know, when everybody was buying the number ones and trying them.
I think it would have definitely sold more if they would have went with
a
new take on the classical character, but keep the foundation intact. Crazy.
That's Ronnie and
Jason.
Rush. Right. Having Jason play the professor role, you know. Yeah. Being the intellect and stuff like that, and I mean it's faithful to the Firestorm dynamic, you know, but it's updated and modernized, but you still have the similar dynamic between a teen that's kind of headstrong and not too bright, you know, and then then you have the intellect that's also along for the ride when they're Firestorm, you know. And having that intellect be Jason instead of the professor, you know, changes it up enough while still being true to the classic concept, you know.
Right. And I like what they're doing with Elemental Woman. She's like the Metamorpho of the New 52. Mm-hmm. And she's got a weirdness to her. Like, she's not all there. Like, she might have lost her humanity somewhat when she turned into this person. Mm. And she's naive, and her brain doesn't work like normal people, but her heart is there. And some of the things she says are just funny. Like, Firestorm's like, I'm running out of oxygen, so I can't make this material because Despero is going to come crashing through. And she goes, well, just breathe me in. I started laughing. I could be oxygen. Just breathe me in. She's so funny. And she was like going to a fast food restaurant, you know, driving the car up and buying fast food for Superman and Batman and everybody. It was hilarious. She brings the humor to the book. But I think that, you know, there's some damn good books in the DC right now. And Justice League and Justice League of America are two of my favorites. Mm-hmm. Like, I read those and I eat them up. Like, I don't see any flaws in them or anything. I just enjoy them. Mm-hmm. And I think they've gotten better, like, with time. They started off kind of like, boom, you know, this is just your action book. But now I'm starting to feel the humanity of the characters, like Geoff Johns did with the JSA. You know what I mean? You know, mm-hmm. He was totally character driven. I'm starting to feel that. That's in the good. Justice League, and it's drawing me in, and you're seeing all the relationships between the characters and what works and how certain characters don't get along with each other, and that's what I dig, man. Maybe, I get caught up in the soap opera.
Yeah. That's definitely DC and Marvel. That's, you know, what it amounts to, kind of, you know?
Right.
I was going to say... maybe he was spread a little too thin before, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Now that he's done with Green Lantern, he can focus a little bit more.
Yeah, it's a fun run. I'm enjoying it. So the last question is from Evan D. Jones or at Crudhead Jones on Twitter. He just asked, were you fans of the Dixon Where Go Robin run? And it says it's what got him into comics. Mm. Yeah, I was a big fan of Robin. I still am. Except now Robin is dead. But I love the Robin run and through all the incarnations of it.
Mm-hmm.
I thought Tim was a damn good Robin, and mm-hmm. he seemed like closer to the detective side and
yeah
the human side of all the Robins to me. Mm-hmm. Like, he always thought with his head. He had a lot of tragedy in his life, especially towards the end. But yeah, I enjoyed Dixon. Dixon writes good action. I mean. He tends to keep things like you learn about a character, but he always has like action payoff. Like
mm-hmm.
he that's what he thrives at, and he's done it in G.I. Joe. He's done it in other books. He's kicked off Birds of Prey. You know, he did a lot of Batman books, and when he tied them all together, they were great. When he did crossovers and stuff, but he's done Nightwing and. Some of his Nightwing run is some of my favorite Nightwing.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, Chuck Dixon is the man. Raringo is his name. He's not one of my favorites because he tends to draw like Ramos or, you know, like Big Feet. But
mm-hmm.
I think he was effective on Robin, and he was definitely effective on Impulse. And I think he's passed away, and I think he left us way too early.
Yeah, he was only in his 40s, I think.
Yeah.
I didn't read a lot of Robin with them on there. You know, back, like a decade or so ago, I did experiment with checking out some Robin solo issues and stuff. It was for the first time, really. And I do like Tim Drake a lot as Robin. I think he might probably be my favorite Robin. I like, Dick Grayson's one of my favorite characters, but I like him as, one of the things I like the most about him is that he's a character who transitioned into a new role and kept it in the fans' favor, you know? Like, he created his own identity as Nightwing, you know?
Yeah.
So, I kind of like him as Nightwing because it symbolizes that. So I like it in that regard. I'm a little more familiar with Dixon's writing on Batman, the main title.
Yeah.
He definitely, for a time there, was one of the biggest contributors to Batman universe.
And I wonder if he was like more focused on the Young Justice. Well, Young Justice, Chuck Dixon didn't do, because we are. Riringo, I can't pronounce his name to save my life. He only did like a few issues. And looking at like the whole entire run, because most of the early issues were Tom Grummett, and then when Tom Grummett left, we had Phil Jimenez for a few issues, and then Para Beck, and then Riringo, and he did a handful of issues, like from 19, roughly, from 19 to, let's see, 28. So I think he's referring to that 1 year, mm-hmm. roughly, that he did stuff. I know he did a lot of Impulse and Young Justice stuff, too.
And Flash itself.
Yeah, he did do Flash proper.
With Mark Waid.
Yeah, kind of like when... let's see, Impulse's mentor was in there. What was his name? God dang it. I can't think of his
name. Max Mercury?
Yeah, Max Mercury, yeah. So, yeah, that's the questions we had. Do you have anything else to add to Robin? Or?
No, I don't think so.
All right. Do any miscellaneous stuff that you read this past break?
Yeah, I read a few different Marvel things.
Cool.
So I could kick off. I read a couple more issues of the first Wolverine solo series. I kept going with that. I'm just really. I'm really loving John Buscema art. He did the first, I think, like 16 issues of this.
Mm-hmm.
And these two issues I read for today, I know that they were definitely ones that I read when I was a kid, because this is a two-part. It's kind of a two-part story, but it also this isn't like trade paperback writing, so they really connect to and continue the stuff that's happened in the first six issues that I've already talked about. But these of Buscema's run on this, these are the two issues of the run that he also inked himself.
Mm-hmm.
So that's just kind of a little trivia. It's kind of cool there.
What was the issues that you're on?
7 and 8.
7 and 8.
So these are the two issues with Mr. Fix-It, a.k.a. the Hulk, the Gray Hulk.
Ah, that's where you left off last week.
Yeah.
Where he was just showing up, like, on the last page, right?
Right, or it might have just been even in, like, the caption just saying that that he'd be showing up next time.
What an odd time. Like, I mean, because Wolverine was Patch and... he was Mr. Fix-It. Just a weird,
exactly.
Just a strange time. I mean,
exactly.
Not only because their aliases have changed, but because of their physical appearances, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's not like a costume type based thing that would draw in people that love heroes. Do you know
right.
what I mean?
It's just, right. Yeah, I really like them as a kid. But I think because of that, they also really stand up. I really, really still liked them, maybe for different reasons, as an adult. And I think I appreciate Buscema's pencils even more so as an adult. I wanted to quickly read this quote that I happened to come across from Bill Sienkiewicz. He inked the last five issues of this Wolverine run of Buscema, and he said, quote, "The sturdiest foundation an inker or an embellisher could possibly hope to build on, and their beauty was not in their attention to fastidiously rendered minutiae, but instead were marvels of deceptive simplicity, each page an example of grace, elegance, and power." So that was kind of a cool quote, and it sort of, I think in some ways it's kind of exemplifies how my own taste has changed. I seem to be gravitating more as an adult to art that's less busy. He talks about minutiae, you know, that when I was a kid comic book fan, a lot of the artists that I like had a lot of busyness, you know, McFarlane,
yeah,
Lee Field, Jim Lee. I mean, just a lot of detail.
Silvestri, yeah.
Silvestri, and I seem to be really gravitate towards a lot of stuff that's
effective, but not as busy storytelling. You know.
Yeah. So, but yeah, these two issues, number seven, is called Mr. Fix-It Comes to Town. And we last left off, you had Wolverine, Jessica Drew, her partner Lindsay McCabe, Karma, formerly of the New Mutants, and a bunch of other folks in the Palace of the Prince of Madripoor. And Karma's uncle, Coy, is trying to take over the crime from this woman named that goes by the name Tiger. And there was a big battle, and the prince shows up at the end of it. So this issue opens up with Mr. Fix-It, the Gray Hulk, who's been hanging out in Vegas. Basically right now, like, the Hulk becomes the Hulk at night, and he turns back into Banner. It's more of a day-night thing. He turns into Banner at night and during the day. And so the Hulk is using he's using sedatives basically that he takes right before dawn to keep Banner asleep all day because he doesn't know what Banner does when he's Banner. So he's trying to really control Banner that way.
That's awesome.
Yeah, and he's working for this guy, Baron Getty in Vegas, and so obviously he's a smart Hulk, who's actually like a pretty straight shooter, so this mafia guy in America contracts with Baron Getty to have the Hulk go over and look into this problem with Coy, Karma's uncle. So that's how the Hulk gets involved. Meanwhile, it's a pretty funny scene where the Prince of Madripoor recognizes Lindsay McCabe, Jessica Drew's partner. She's a B-movie actress, and he turns out to be a huge fan of hers. So that's what stops them from all getting killed and sort of delays the action. Ultimately, Wolverine helps convince Tiger to an agreement that she'll continue to handle the crime that she had been, but the stuff that she wasn't doing, like the darker crimes like drugs and prostitution and stuff like that, she will let Coy operate in those arenas. And Wolverine's whole thing is he wants to stop Coy eventually, but it's not the time. So it's kind of interesting, like, characterization, because Wolverine's kind of willing to let this stuff go on for a little bit longer with a long-term goal, where, like, maybe some other superheroes just wouldn't be able to tolerate working in that kind of gray area. It turns out that the Prince is such a fan of Lindsay McCabe. There's this scene where they go into a room and he's got a whole, like, creepy shrine to her, including, like, statues of her in her various different roles, like movie posters, and she's pretty flattered by it, but it was pretty kind of, like, it's kind of scary.
Stalker scary.
Yeah, pretty much. So that situation is kind of temporarily resolved, but it's still Wolverine's still sort of concerned about Karma and her situation, and she's not willing to leave because she's the whole reason she's there with her uncle is it's for some reason that's the only way, like, her brother and sister have been kidnapped and are missing, and that's the only way that she's feels like she can find them. Wolverine agrees to help her out, and they know that this Mr. Fix-It guy is supposed to be coming to deal with the problem of problem that was actually created by Wolverine a couple issues ago, if you remember, when they destroyed him and Archie Goodwin destroyed Coy's opium farms. That delayed their shipments to America, and so that's why this mafia guy in America was looking for somebody to go look into it. But the Hulk doesn't really know exactly, you know, the whole story behind it. So at the end of the issue, Mr. Fix-It arrives at the airport, and Wolverine, you know, sees that Mr. Fix-It. He recognizes him as the Hulk, you know, from a distance. So he follows him and breaks into his hotel room during the day, and that's when he confirms his suspicions because he sees Banner lying on the bed, passed out in the Hulk's huge suit. Because as Mr. Fix-It, the Hulk wears specially tailored three-piece suits. Pretty awesome. Issue 8 is called If It Ain't Broke, and again, this is Chris Claremont writing and John Buscema doing the pencils and inks.
Did you read these off the rack when they came out?
Originally, yeah.
What drew you to the characters being that Hulk was in a suit and Wolverine was in a suit?
You know, I think I was found it pretty fascinating.
Well, how old were you when you read it? Roughly.
I think I was in middle school. So.
Ah. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, I wasn't super young. I was probably like 11, something like that. 12, maybe. So. And I just really liked, I loved Wolverine back then.
It didn't matter what he was wearing as long as he popped his claws.
Yeah, and they're exciting issues, you know, like they have a real, like, 70s film quality to them, I thought. 8 is just an iconic issue for me. This is the one that has Hulk and Wolverine on the cover. Wolverine's kind of like leaning on the Hulk. I think my buddy and I traded this issue back and forth a few dozen times. We both loved it, but this one's called If It Ain't Broke. And it's really amusing. Wolverine keeps playing. Wolverine knows Hulk is the Hulk. Mr. Fix-It is the Hulk. But the Hulk doesn't know Patch is Wolverine. At least not at first. And so Wolverine really, even though the Hulk is a smart Hulk, Wolverine kind of uses him and plays with him throughout the whole issue. And one of the most amusing things he does is having snuck into his hotel room at the end of last issue, he steals all of the Hulk's luggage and replaces everything with purple pants. So there's just a bunch of giant purple pants laying around when the Hulk, you know, resumes control. Purple pants, of course, being what the gray or the Green Hulk tends to wear, and a note. He leaves them a note telling them, you know, we know who you are. Get out of town. Of course, he doesn't, and he shows up at a club later where Patch is at in a newly tailored suit that he got somewhere nearby, and Patch and Mr. Fix-It end up kind of teaming up. Patch takes Mr. Fix-It to a place where he knows that that women are being kidnapped and sold into slavery, but he's never... So the people that are doing there recognize Patch, but he hasn't had the muscle power to really break up what they're doing. So he takes advantage of the fact that the Hulk is there and sort of tricks him into getting involved with these people. And once the Hulk sees that, you know, what they're doing, he doesn't need any more convincing, and he helps Wolverine take them down. But that's not really what he's there for. You know, he's kind of being distracted from his duties. And there's another funny sequence where all the girls that they rescued are real, like, happy and thankful to them. And, like, as he's passing out, you know, the Hulk is in a bath and there's all these women around. Then he wakes up and realizes that, like, that it was Banner that really got to enjoy the whole the whole thing, because the women are gone when he wakes up as the Hulk. So there's another sequence where they get to a place nearby, Koi's cocaine plants, or really cocaine like factory refinery, and Wolverine disappears when he's led Hulk out onto a porch, and he drops down and at this point hasn't unleashed his claws around Hulk because he doesn't want to be recognized. And but once he's out of sight, he unleashes his claws and uses them to cut the supports of the porch, and it drops Hulk 1,000 feet down.
He can't figure it out, even though he's got hair. Nobody else.
Throughout these issues, it does require, like, Wolverine's always making a point, you know, not to unleash his claws around people, because as if that's the one thing that people will recognize him. It does require, like, a little bit of suspension of disbelief, because, like you said, he has such a distinct
hairstyle,
you know. But if you're willing to go with that, and, you know, the fact that at this point the X-Men are supposed to be dead, which is why he's being careful about his identity, then it works. But he does, once, so his claws make that telltale noise, and the Hulk does hear that noise and think, wait a minute, I think I know that noise. And then that's when he's dropped, and he falls 1,000 feet, and Wolverine does this purposely to piss him off and drop him in the middle of the cocaine plants. which get destroyed in the battle basically, and Wolverine reveals to the Hulk that the mafioso in America has lied both to the Hulk and to his employer, Berengetti. You know, and Hulk has no interest in helping out organized crime and helping out with the drug trade. So they put a stop to that. Wolverine's kind of used Hulk to further his own goals, and but the two of them are on pretty good terms when all is said and done. You know, Wolverine sends him helps him book his flight back to the United States, and but he plays one last trick on him by you know, he basically books him on a flight, tells him, you know, yes, I made sure it's a nighttime flight. You won't turn back into Banner in the air. You know, it's going to be daytime the whole, or it's going to be nighttime the whole flight back. And then after the after Hulk's on the plane, it's revealed that Wolverine switched the signs around and he got on a flight that's going to be daylight the whole time. So basically fucks up the Hulk, the whole issue. But you know, like there's like another sequence where that brand new suit that the Hulk got gets ruined almost immediately, and he has to troop around in purple pants after all, because that's the only thing Wolverine says that he can find for him to wear in the meantime. So Wolverine gets his wish and gets him to walk around looking like the Green Hulk after all.
Was it self-contained, or was it like crossing over to the Hulk?
It was self-contained. I can't remember if Wolverine made an appearance in the Hulk issue around the same time, but you didn't have to read it for this story.
Cool.
Yeah, so it just kind of fits into the continuity of where the Hulk was at that time. But and, you know, this is... You can kind of read these two series by them, or these two issues by themselves, but they do tie into what came before. After this, they take kind of a break. There's a couple one-shot stories, it looks like, and then it kind of starts up a new little bit of a longer story that again takes place in Madripoor. So,
cool,
really good stuff. I mean, holds up even better than I expected these to hold up when I decided to start checking these old Wolverine issues out.
Interesting to hear, because you probably read that story so many times. Like you said, yeah. You traded it back and forth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I read it a lot, you know, in middle school, and I haven't read it since, you know, so it's been like quite a few years.
Cool deal. My brother gave me his Wolverine copies to sell. I just haven't put them on eBay yet because of all the cons and stuff.
Yeah.
And if I need correspondence or whatever, I wouldn't be answering anybody. So when I get back, I'm going to put his Wolverine run. And it has all those issues you're talking about.
Mm.
And he's got the original four, the...
Oh.
Ones that are a little more expensive.
Right, yeah.
Yeah. So, I didn't get a lot of time to read a lot of older stuff, but I did start, in the previous episode, I talked about the Legion of Superheroes, and it got me to buy some more Legion books. And this is Legion Lost, the first series that happened in 2000.
Nice, I've read that.
Yeah, and... It's a little interesting because this is the time I kind of dropped off of Legion, and it was weird for me too because they were changing names. Like Shadow Lass was now Umbra, and you know, Phantom Lady was now not Phantom Lady. Phantom Lass was now Apparition, and you know the names were changing, and I didn't understand why. And Kid Quantum and. They had a character called Monstrous, and I don't remember her at all. She seems to be like the strong, like block, you know, like the strong one in this group. But it focuses on, it's a weird time, but you enter into a world where there's these creatures that are kind of like the Borg, but not. Instead of assimilating you, they use your matter and regenerate their own people or something. They use you as like an energy source, and they hunt you down and kill you because you're it's almost like if you were everything else, everybody else is a mutant except for your race, and you're hunting down all those people and killing them. So there's this character called Shikari, or I guess her name eventually becomes Lone Star, but she's like a tracker of some sort, but they're hunting down her people, and she happens to hide in a building, and you're like, oh, it looks like a building that's been destroyed, and it's part of the Legion Tower, and she sees a hologram of Element Lab, who's kind of like telling her the story of what happened and what's going on, and she does find these other Legionnaires that actually made the transition, which are Chameleon Kid, Apparition, Brainiac 5, Kid Quantum, Livewire. See, Livewire was Lightning Lad, you know? That's just one of the weird things I find. Some of the name changes is just bizarre. And they don't know why they got there or what's going on. Just that they're fighting these beings who are trying to assimilate them or trying to kill them. And they seem pretty effective in fighting them, but they're on the run. So it's like they're in another dimension that Brainiac 5 has no idea existed. Like he doesn't even know, like by looking at the stars or doing mathematical calculations, like where the hell they are. He just knows that they want to try to get back home, and that's about as far as I got. I read 1 through 3.
Oh, okay.
And it's a 12-issue miniseries by Abnett and Lanning, and Coppell is the artist, Oliver Coppell.
Yeah, I like his art on that series. I think at the time it was pretty much intended to be, a straight-up reboot in a lot of ways.
And I think it was successful. Like, I remember people talking about it. I never bought it, but I remember in the comic shops and such, that Legion was being talked about heavily, and this was 12-issue mini, and it launched into Legion Worlds. And was this post Legionnaires, like when they canceled all the titles, or?
Yeah, it was Legion Lost, and Legion Worlds was a 5 or 6 issue miniseries that each issue went to a different planet, and connected to a Legion member. But yeah, I went into just the series that was just called Legion, that ran for like 30 something issues. Most of them were by Abnett and Lanning, and at the time it was just kind of a new version of the Legion. When that got canceled, that's when the series that Mark Waid started out writing, with Barry Kitson drawing, was considered once again to be another reboot. And then there you have like the three different versions of the Legion that Geoff Johns ended up tying together.
I can't understand why it's not like a successful franchise, like as far as sales go, because it reminds me, I mean, not because it reminds me a lot of like the X-Men, because there's so many of them. Like, and X-Men is successful, and it adds a sci-fi element to it that's really cool, and there's just a lot of stuff going on that's really cool to play with, and it's kind of disappointing that it never can. It has to be relaunched over and over and over again. Although I think in the New 52 they botched that relaunch more so than any of the others.
Well, cause, because yeah,
it really wasn't a jumping off. It wasn't a relaunch. It's almost like they kept you doing with what they were doing in the past with Adventure Comics and Legion of Superheroes before the New 52 went away.
Yeah, that was the time when they should have rebooted it and they didn't.
Yeah, because it had a lot of opportunity to pull in some new people.
Yep. But, actually, the Abnett Landing series is what got me interested in the Legion. I knew... I got into it once the ongoing had started and caught up with it. It was just getting such good reviews at the time. I decided to check it out and really liked it and started buying it monthly. And I kept up with, I was a little confused at first going into, but I kept up buying Legion monthly for a while with the Wade run too, which threw me off a little bit because when I first started reading it, I didn't know it was a reboot and wasn't real familiar with old Legion stuff. So, but I liked that as well. And, eventually read some of the more classic stuff. But it's a good series. You get Darkseid coming back. That was a really good storyline when Manning kind of did their dark side, Great Darkness story.
Where did that happen?
I think it's maybe in the 20s.
And which one of the Legionnaires?
No, the Abnett Landing had a dark side story. I'm trying to think what it was called. Kind of like, playing off the history that was there as a result of the Great Darkness Saga.
Ah, I'd like to read that because I really enjoyed that. I thought it was cool too how they didn't have Wildfire initially, like they just found his energy signature, and Brainiac 5 was able to whip some armor up and. Make him an effective member because he seems really powerful, like one of their more powerhouses. And I just don't understand his powers totally, other than it's so much energy that he could put out a radiation or something.
Yeah, I didn't even really, I think at the time the way they introduced him, I didn't realize till I looked into it that he wasn't, a new character.
Yeah. His costume looks really different here. But it's cool because, like, issue one introduces you to the story. Issue two kind of focuses. And then it goes into a weird mode where you get, like, what this character thinks of the team. Like, one focuses on Monstrous, the captions. And the captions change to the logo of the character. And then you get Kid Quantum. You're seeing through her eyes what's going on. Mm-hmm. And I think the next one is Apparition. Like, I haven't started reading issue 4 yet, but on issue 4 it has her on the cover. Coppell's style is really different in this too. Like, it doesn't look like he draws today at all. It's very sketchy. I like it a lot. It's real dark and sketchy. A lot of line work in there that looks like he. I wonder if he's. Did he ink his own stuff? Yeah, he did. No, Andy Lanning inked his stuff.
Hmm.
Because he's an inker.
Yeah. But yeah, their whole run, I definitely recommend have Abnett and Lanning on it.
Yeah. So, yeah, that just shows, I read the Great Darkness Saga and it got me to buy or seek out some more stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Now I'm on my pulp thing, so. Damn, these books. No.
I got one other thing that I could talk about.
Sure. What do you got?
So this is a little topical in terms of what's going on in present-day Marvel, and also kind of relates to a listener that wrote in a couple of months ago, I guess, probably now, named Steve. One of the things that he said that he'd be interested in hearing about on the show was Infinity Gauntlet, which is something that I read when I was younger. What I decided to do first, though, was to kind of go and read a little bit of the Silver Surfer that led into Infinity Gauntlet, because I was also reading those and a fan of those when I was younger. And I think this would be the Jim Starlin, Ron Lim. I liked Ron Lim's art, and I still do like it today. I think these issues really kind of fascinated me when I was a kid, because I really wasn't Silver Surfer stuff and the Marvel Cosmic stuff. I really wasn't reading anything else like that when I was younger. And I found really kind of interesting these weird characters that you didn't really see as much in other books. I read 34, 35, and 36, and these are all, like I said, by Jim Starlin and Ron Lim. 34 is called Even Demigods Must Dream, and that's pretty descriptive. I mean, essentially, the whole issue is what you at first think is a dream. Silver Surfer lands on a desert planet and decides to go to sleep for the first time in years. I guess he is pretty tired.
Does it actually say that?
Yeah, he says something like,
I haven't closed my eyes for...
Yeah, something to that effect. I'm definitely not, that's definitely not my editorializing. But yeah, he wakes up and doesn't realize, well, he thinks he wakes up, and where there was nothing before, there's a castle made out of a giant skull. Kind of looks almost like Castle Grayskull from He-Man. And it's pretty creepy looking, and he goes in and he follows two creatures that are carrying a box. And they're talking, and they don't really pay any attention to him, so he assumes he's dreaming. And he's like, this is really fascinating. You know, not only have I not slept for years, I haven't dreamt, obviously, so I'm just going to follow them, see where this leads, and you know. So the creatures take this box into a throne room, and on the throne is Death, the goddess. And the box releases a spirit, and it's Thanos in spirit form, just kind of his head, who they have an exchange with Death, and Death explains, you know, I'm releasing you because I have a job for you to do. And the only one that might stop you is the Silver Surfer. And then at that point, they all turn and look at him, and he freaks out because he thought he was dreaming and they couldn't see him. So there's this kind of weird, trippy dream sequence, but then basically he does kind of seem to wake up, or at least he's back in this desert area and the skull castle's gone. But then it's just really awesome final page, which I tweeted yesterday, where it's a splash page and Thanos shows up in the flesh on his chair that he stole from Metron, and you know Silver Surfer asks, who are you? And you know, it just ends with Thanos saying his name. Really cool last page.
What issue was this one again?
34.
Well, that was really pre-Infinity then. Gauntlet, right?
Yeah, well, I think... yeah, there was like...
It's at least a year away, right?
There was like a five-issue story or five issues of Silver Surfer that kind of tie in. This is where Thanos comes back, basically. Then there's the two-issue Thanos Rising, which is where Thanos goes around and collects the Infinity Gems. And then that goes into... So, yeah, it's a year, maybe a little less than a year.
Yeah.
But I thought I'd read these five or six Silver Surfer issues in Thanos Rising before I dug into.
It's cool because you're exploring stuff I don't have. I mean, you're exploring stuff.
And
that,
I don't...
That's pretty odd.
I mean... Yeah. Yeah, what are the chances? No, I don't know why I ended up reading this stuff. It doesn't seem like the kind of thing I would have grabbed off the shelf, but I think I just got one of these Silver Surfer issues. I started reading it before 34, but I think I just got a Silver Surfer issue with Ron Limhart in one of those Marvel grab bags that I got that got me into comics in the first place, and I read everything that I got in those, and I think I just liked it. Otherwise, I don't think I would have. And I kept up with it. I know I was still reading it, like, you know, at least through issue 50, which is like a special cover and stuff. And I read it Infinity Gauntlet and stuff. And I remember articles in Comic Book News and stuff about it. But so I read this time. I also read 35 and 36. And, you know, 35 is called this. The name is Thanos. And it's basically, you know, the whole issue kind of is Thanos invites Silver Surfer to hop onto his Metron chair. You know, it's funny, I'm saying that, and I actually did do a little reading, and I found out that originally, like, when Thanos was invented, he looked, not only did he have a chair that looked like Metron's, he looked kind of like Metron himself. And Roy Thomas looked at it and said, if you're going to rip off one of the new guys, at least rip off the cool one and make him look like Darkseid. So they made him look a lot beefier, and size-wise made him look more like Darkseid, but they kept the Metron chair. So it's basically Darkseid riding Metron's chair.
Yeah, it's very similar to, I mean, yeah. Character.
So, this issue pretty much is just, you know, he takes Silver Surfer around the universe. You know, he can travel in space and time like Metron can, and he tells him why Death brought him back. His job is basically to solve the environmental problems of the universe, overpopulation and whatnot. They go to Earth, but they go other places that have similar problems as Earth. And it's a genuine problem, but their solution is pretty extreme. Thanos is going to euthanize 50% of the universe. So he's basically going to kill 50% of all the beings in the entire universe to solve the environmental problem. Silver Surfer obviously is freaked out by this and plans on posing him. But Thanos gets a nice little trick in because one of the... worlds they visited had these nice little peaceful creatures that so far hadn't had an overpopulation problem, so they're living peaceably. Thanos says, you know, eventually they're going to go to war because they're going to run out of space, and Silver Surfer's like, well, I'll leave them be for now, they're happy. Once they're gone, Thanos says, you know, you've already helped me because you remember that planet we went to. Well, we went to Earth first, and you picked up germs from Earth, and thanks to you, those germs were introduced to that other planet we went to, and I've jumped us forward in time, and so about half of that population is dead now because of the diseases that you carried yourself on your body that we introduced to their system that weren't native to their habitat. So it's a pretty nasty trick, and so Silver Surfer takes off, goes back. Sure enough, there's like piles and piles of dead that are being like burned. And Silver Surfer does what he can. He introduces a cure to one of the populations so that cure will spread and he can save as many people as he can. But then he basically just sticks around to help them clean up their dead.
How does he come up with the cure? Like, science-based cure, or is his power inducing the cure or something?
It's related to his power, I guess. He can inoculize or whatever. His own metabolism is capable of synthesizing it, and then he introduces it to one of the creatures so that it'll spread to the other creatures. And then at the end of the issue, Kronos, knowing that Thanos is back now, raises Drax the Destroyer from the dead to go after him. And finally, 36 is called The Lesson. There's really only two things to this issue. Silver Surfer goes to Earth and to Avengers Mansion and hangs out with Captain America, and they basically... The pretense is that the Silver Surfer is doing some research on Thanos. He doesn't really know Thanos, but he knows that the Avengers have faced him in the past, so he goes to do some research, basically. So Captain America basically tells them essentially what, recaps for the reader, Thanos's two previous appearances. I haven't read these myself, but these are, you know, these did occur in, involved Captain Marvel, you know, the Marvel, and Adam Warlock. So these are really stories that happened.
His first appearance, though, was in Iron Man, wasn't it?
I don't know.
Yeah, I think it is.
But it basically kind of recaps that history for the reader. And for Silver Surfer. And then the second half, when he goes back to space, he runs into the Impossible Man. And Impossible Man changes shape like every single panel. And Silver Surfer is like, has no time for him. But Impossible Man persists because he's like, I heard Thanos is going to wipe out half of the population of the universe. And I'm part of the population of the universe. And what if he chooses my half? So... You're way too serious. You're way too much like Thanos. And you need to be able to... You can't outpower him. You blasted him straight in the face and it didn't even affect him. You need to be able to be more different than Thanos. And one of the ways you need to be different is to be able to have a sense of humor. So I'm going to bother you until you start to have a sense of humor. And he basically does. And then finally, Silver Surfer like makes a joke... without even really intending to, and that satisfies Impossible Man, and he takes off.
Was it funny?
It was kind of a joke.
Yeah.
I'm sure, not really. It wasn't a very good one, but it was a start. It was a start.
I've never liked that character.
He's a little annoying, but
he's like the Mixleplick of...
Yeah.
...of the Marvel Universe.
Yep. Yep. So, out of the three, I mean, this issue didn't really do a whole lot to further the plot, like, but I guess it was helpful, especially in the 80s, to, we didn't have as easy access to older issues, you know, to give you some history on Thanos, and the art was still good.
Yeah.
So.
That's cool. Cool deal.
Another...
Are you gonna keep running it, I mean, reading until you hit the Infinity Gauntlet?
I think I am, because I'm really enjoying revisiting. I don't really remember it, and Thanos is back in a big way, and I like Wolverine. I'm actually finding that these I do believe that if I read these for the first time now, I would still like them. These ones hold up too, like the Wolverine issues. So I kind of want to. It was a good suggestion from Steve, and I really want to sort of refresh my memory of this stuff.
Right.
So, I think I shall.
Any other books you check out?
No, I think that's it for this time.
Yeah, I'll have more for next time. I just had to take things on the plane and I decided to read Mind Management, and
yeah,
I'm still behind in Walking Dead, but I got through volume 6.
Yeah, I read some new stuff. I have this mammoth pile of new comics to read right now. I got to catch up on, and I started in on that. I also read the first trade of Hawkeye, because I hadn't been reading that.
Yeah, that's good.
That's like awesome. It. Yeah, it's pretty funny.
I just don't understand, like, Matt Fraction could, like, sometimes be like a genius, like, with I loved his Iron Man stuff, and I loved his what else did he do? I can't remember what else he. Iron Fist.
Iron Fist.
Yeah, and then like Hawkeye, and then he writes Fantastic Four, and I don't like it. I like FF, but it's FF is like so weird. Like, it's like they just purposely got four characters that they didn't give a crap about and put them in a team and say, oh, well, you only have to be the Fantastic Four for 4 minutes because that's all the whole time we're going to be gone in the universe. It'll seem like 4 minutes to you, but that didn't work out, so it's more than 4 minutes.
Of course.
But I like that book, but I just not feeling the Fantastic Four proper.
Yeah, I don't know if he's a writer that is good at all tones, you know? Maybe
he can't do a team book. I don't know.
I don't know. Or maybe it's just like, you know, like Hawkeye is pretty crazy in its own way. It's definitely a lot of like humor and stuff like that, and he seems to be really good at that kind of tone.
Yeah,
you know, the kind of crazy stuff, you know. So I don't know, but I liked it was like the first 5 issues. I liked it a lot. It's pretty awesome. It's just like I think a lot of people have seen this panel, but there's this really funny panel where he's naked and like jumping through the air, and to like block out his penis they just put like a big like Hawkeye face and like the purple mask, because normally in the series not really in like outfits, he doesn't really wear that outfit anymore anyways, but it's just like that's what covers his junk. It looks pretty hilarious. But the art, like that, I mean, I love this kind of art. Like the first 3 issues are David Aja, and then
Iron Fist, yeah.
Yeah, and issues 4 and 5 are Javier Pulido. Man, I love both of them.
Yeah, he's keeping the same type of style, though, with the artists he's choosing.
Yeah, it's kind of the same. Like, I love all the artists that they get for Daredevil also. I love that. Javier Pulido has done that. Whoa.
What happened?
A bunch of trades just
fell
over and
knocked your juice.
I have on the shelf there's trades like are like half the shelf, and then I have these my mom when I was a kid made she used to go to ceramics.
Yeah.
And she made me a ceramic Snoopy, Woodstock, and Charlie Brown.
Uh-huh.
And she pulled them out of storage for me. Like, these are from when I was a little kid. They were, like, in my room when I was a baby. And I think, like, the date on them is from when I was, like, 2 years old. So they're going through the basement. Like, they're still slowly, like, finding stuff in their house that's mine and being like, come look at this stuff. What do you want?
Do you want it?
But that's because I've gotten, like, in recent years, gotten known for liking the Peanuts again.
Yeah.
She's like, I have something for you to check out, and I didn't know what it was, and I'd totally forgotten that they existed, and I opened up the box and saw them in there and just, like, flipped out. I was like, this is why I like Snoopy nowadays, because I was programmed as a child. So I got those on the shelf now, and thankfully nothing. It was noisy, but nothing happened to him. But American and Barbarian attacked Snoopy and Charlie Brown.
I thought you were going to yell, help!
Yeah. Your co-hosts have mishaps
yeah.
while they're recording with you.
That's right. Well, I've had several, usually because I'm laughing, but
yeah,
I've destroyed several books, spitting up coke and all kinds of stuff.
Well, I think I first time I was ever on DC Noise, I spit beer all over my computer.
So, I've done that, but not beer, but
drinks. Yeah.
All right, you want to wrap this one up?
Yeah, might as well.
Okie dokie. This has been episode, what episode, 14?
14.
Retrocast 14, Geek Brunch Retrocast. You can check out our Facebook page at Geek Brunch Podcast. You search for it and you click the like button. You can see covers of all the books that we cover on this show, as well as you'll have episode links there. And if you go to Forum for Geeks and scroll down to Geek Brunch, you can see that information there as well. And you can reach Chris at on Twitter at MythMakingETC. You just recently celebrated your Critical Masses anniversary, right?
Oh, yeah. CriticalMassesMedia.com, the website I started with my buddies Ryan and Matt, it's been just over 3 years ago we started it. You can check it out for most of the stuff that on the website is like music and movie related reviews and stuff. And Ryan and Matt, along with on some episodes, Ryan's brother's on, and I think there's another guy that joins them sometimes. They've done about 4 or 5 episodes of a podcast called the Critical Masses Podcast, which at some point I may appear on. And what they usually do is talk about one music album and one movie per episode. So check that out if it sounds interesting.
Very cool. Do you got anything else you want to mention?
No, I think our email's mythmakingetc@gmail.com. Mike is mike@comicbooknoise.com. Of course, Mike also does the regular Geek Brunch with Bill and Micah, as we've made mention of, where they cover modern movies and TV and
it's a smorgasbord. Books. It could be new, it could be old.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's true. Because
that's the one free for all one. You can talk about anything. You talked about vegan stuff.
Yeah,
that's insane. We ate vegan, me and Daryl. Did you see that plot?
That I saw that. I'm surprised you guys had room for a whole potted plant after eating.
Right after Five Guys.
Yeah,
we hated a plot.
You know, like a lot of times people write LOL and when they think something's funny, but they're not actually literally laughing out loud. I saw that picture and I just totally busted it.
Well, it all spawned off of Keith.
Right.
Because we were eating all innocently at Five Guys and then Keith has to go and instigate stuff saying, well, I'm eating at Luna's. I'm eating healthy. Mm-hmm. I'm eating so healthy. Look at Daryl and Mike. They're eating at Five Guys, all that junk food. I don't know why he did that. Like, he's like telling on us, like Michelle, look, I'm eating good, but those guys aren't.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
he's drinking like a keg of beer every night, which offsets all the healthy food that he ate.
And then the next night he was out with you guys eating wings, wasn't he?
Oh, yeah, and burgers. Yeah. And
yeah. I thought it was funny to go along with it,
I was like, Daryl, let's take – he's over there. Let's take a picture because we saw this potted plant that looked like a bowl and it had flowers and all kinds of green stuff. And we're like, let's take a picture of us, like, going to eat it.
Yeah, it's a pretty hilarious idea.
Yeah, but he did eat vegan at Luna's.
Yeah, which that's pretty intense. Like, they're not only vegan, they're raw.
Yeah.
So it's all like not even, you know, I eat a lot of vegetarian, but I mean, it's a lot of usually like cooked and whatnot. But
yeah, It didn't look appetizing to me at all, but that's me. I don't mind vegetables and stuff as long as they're cooked and there's lots of sauce, but
mm-hmm.
That looked like weeds. I was like, Keith, you can come to my backyard and eat that.
Yeah. That was pretty funny. Yeah, I think he was just trying to score points with this lady.
Yeah. So, yeah, that's all I have. I'm going to record Geek Brunch, hopefully, here with Micah. And I'll try to get this episode out today, because next week I'll be in comic book mode again.
Yep.
And then things will go back to some normal. Unless you have do you have summer vacation coming up?
I got a trip planned, but it's like during the week.
Oh, okay.
I don't know if I really have any plans to be away on the weekend coming up soon, at least.
And you're still trying to go to Baltimore, right?
Yep. Yeah, I was just kind of like looking into it a bit this morning. I see that they're probably any day now going to put out hotel specials.
Yeah.
But I was just kind of pricing things and stuff. Nice thing is that Southwest flies right from Buffalo to Baltimore. So air flight might not be too expensive, or shouldn't be too expensive.
Uh-huh.
Which I'll probably do, because it's like an hour flight versus a like 8 hour, 8.5 hour drive. Mm-hmm. So I used to do drives like that all the time, but I don't, after about 3.5-4 hours, I start to get sore.
Yeah, it's you only want to do those if you have plenty of vacation. That way you could break it up and say, well, I'm going to drive here and stop here halfway or a quarter of the way and do this, and then mm-hmm. drive the rest of the way. Those are rough if you just do it one shot.
Yep.
Over the weekend.
Dang, it was different. And you felt like you saved money when gas was cheaper, but you don't really save much money either anymore.
Yeah.
So.
All right, well, cool deal. You have a good week, and I will talk to you soon.
Yeah, you too.
Take care.
All right.
Bye.
Bye.
Yeah.